Welcome to Managing AML. I am Dr. Eitan Stein. I will be reviewing two abstracts on enasidenib in mutant IDH2-positive acute myeloid leukemia that were presented at the European Hematology Association's annual congress. The first abstract I'm going to be discussing is an abstract about enasidenib monotherapy in patients with newly diagnosed and untreated AML that has an IDH2 mutation. The second abstract I'm going to be discussing is going to be about continuing enasidenib in patients with stable disease and what the outcomes of those patients are. So let's get to the first abstract first. So as everyone likely knows, mutations in isocitrate dehydrogenase 2 are seen in approximately 15% of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. And what happens when you have a mutation in IDH2 is that instead of isocitrate being converted to alpha-ketoglutarate, alpha-ketoglutarate is converted to beta-hydroxyglutarate. And when you have increased intracellular levels of beta-hydroxyglutarate, that causes a block in myeloid differentiation through a variety of biological mechanisms. And if you can drug that mutation such that you lower the levels of intracellular beta-hydroxyglutarate, you can then cause myeloid differentiation to again progress normally, and therefore get rid of acute myeloid leukemia. So enasidenib has already been approved for the treatment of relapsed and refractory acute myeloid leukemia based on the results of a large phase 1-2 study, which showed that the overall response rate of the drug as a single agent in the relapsed and refractory setting was approximately 40%, with about 20% of those patients achieving a complete remission and a median overall survival in the range of 8.5 to 9 months. So in this abstract, what the authors were interested in looking at was what happens if you give this enasidenib IDH2 inhibitor to patients with newly diagnosed AML. And this was part of the larger phase 1-2 study, but it was a separate cohort. So in this study, there were 39 untreated patients with IDH2 mutant acute myeloid leukemia. These patients were ineligible for induction chemotherapy or other standard of care therapy, either de facto or what we normally do, which is hypomethylating agents. That was decided by their local physician. And because of that, they were enrolled on the study where they would get single agent enasidenib. The median age of these patients was quite old. It was 77 years old. And the breakdown of the two subtypes of IDH2 mutations that we see, the R140 mutation versus the R172 mutation, was approximately 70% R140 mutants and 30% R172 mutants. The outcomes of these patients were quite good. And what I mean by that is that the overall response rate was 31%, with 18% of the patients achieving a true complete remission. And the median overall survival in this small study of all these patients was 11.3 months. I think what this represents is actually a very low toxicity regimen that can be used in those patients where one might not feel comfortable giving them a drug which is myelosuppressive, certainly like induction chemotherapy, but also a drug like azacitidine or decitabine. And that group of patients that are really so old or so infirm, that really all they can tolerate is an oral medication, which really has minimal side effects. Based on these data, the NCCN has actually included in their guidelines that for newly diagnosed AML patients older than age 60 with an IDH2 mutation, enasidenib would be considered an acceptable alternative to what we currently do, which is low-dose cytarabine or hypomethylating agents. The second abstract I wanted to discuss was the abstract about what happens to patients with relapsed and refractory AML who receive enasidenib, who have stable disease as their best response after 3 cycles of therapy. So one of the things we know about enasidenib is that, like any differentiating agent, what happens when you take this drug is that it takes time for cells to differentiate. That is, the median time to best response in the group of patients with relapsed and refractory AML is 3.7 months. So we asked ourselves, well, what if you have a patient that you're treating with enasidenib and they've gotten 3 cycles of therapy, so 90 days of therapy, and you do a bone marrow biopsy and their bone marrow biopsy hasn't changed much. That is, they started at 60% blasts and they ended at 60% blasts, or they ended at 50% blasts. But they certainly have not achieved a response yet. Should you continue giving patients enasidenib, or should you call it a day and move on to something else? So we looked at all of the patients on the study who had been on enasidenib for 90 days, and their best response after 90 days was stable disease. And we asked ourselves, well, what happens to these patients who are continued on enasidenib? And the answer was that about a third of the patients will actually go on to achieve a complete remission or a response. It can be something less than a complete remission, like a complete remission with incomplete count recovery. A third of the patients will maintain stable disease as their best response, and then a third of the patients will develop progressive disease. So what you can legitimately tell your patients is that if they have stable disease for 90 days, there's about a 33% chance that with continued administration of enasidenib, they will go and they will have a response. By having a response, that actually translates into obviously better overall survival, so that if you compare the patients who have a response to the patients who don't have a response after 90 days, after three cycles, the patients who don't have a response obviously don't live as long as the patients who do have a response. I think the last thing which is important is that what we're trying to figure out now is, well, can we identify at day 90, who are the patients, who is that 33% of patients who are destined to respond? Do we know, can we identify them so that we don't put 66% of the patients on continued therapy when they're not going to benefit from it? So there's some thought that it may have to do with the molecular alterations that are present in the myeloblasts in addition to IDH2, such that patients with FLT3 abnormalities are probably less likely to be in that group of patients who end up responding than patients who do not have FLT3 abnormalities, but that is information that is still being analyzed. I think, again, that both of these abstracts show the power of differentiating therapy for acute myeloid leukemia, the power of an oral agent that can be taken in home for patients with relapsed and refractory disease, and really I do think represents a new standard of care for IDH2 mutant patients with AML. Thank you very much for viewing this activity.